Hello and welcome to the Real Maxime podcast. I'm Maxime, your host. I'm an economist, former tech entrepreneur, hedge fund founder, and private investor. The growth of private markets over the past few decades has led to an enormous number of GPs from which to choose. Market research firm PitchBook is currently tracking well over 10,000 open funds seeking LP commitments. Two decades of allocation data and fund performance clearly show size and specialization as standout conditioning factors. Emerging managers tend to be smaller, which can increase the potential upside that a GP can achieve due to the diminishing returns of larger scale firms. Smaller size also means lower management fees in nominal terms, making performance incentives a bigger driver of smaller GPs' economics, amplifying interest alignment with LPs. Within both the established and emerging manager groups, specialists outperform their generalist peers. Specialists often have an advantage from a sourcing perspective, as founders operating in a highly specialized space likely prefer working with a sector-dedicated fund. Specialists are overall more likely to generate higher returns, a trend corroborated by top and bottom quartile excess IRRs of specialists exceeding those of their generalist counterparts, regardless of experience. My guest today is guaranteed to be a force to be reckoned with in early-stage financial technology venture investing. Anna Garcia is the founding managing partner of Altari Ventures, an emerging venture capital manager specializing in enterprise fintech at earliest stages. Fintech's share of financial services is expected to grow more than sixfold to $1.5 trillion in 2030. That's the value created by companies selling to incumbents to help them compete on one hand, and companies building alternative solutions outside of existing financial services firms on the other. The Altari investment thesis is informed by Anna's background on Wall Street and witnessing the modernization of financial processes firsthand. Starting on the trading floor at Merrill Lynch, Anna steadily climbed the firm's ranks to managing director, ultimately leading debt capital markets effort for government agency, sovereign, and supranational clients. After subsequent stints at Jefferies and JP Morgan, Anna discovered a growing passion working with emerging technology founders while mentoring and angel investing. Building on early investing successes like Trumid and the acquisition of Live Oak by DocuSign, Anna parlayed her track record into launching her first fund, Altari Ventures Fund 1, in the summer of 2023. In this insightful conversation, we discuss Anna's international upbringing and education in Denmark and the UK, the key takeaways from Wall Street on how it prepared and still educates her unique underwriting approach, and what meaningful enterprise trends in financial services have the potential to create substantial economic value for investors. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I grew up in Europe. I was born in Russia, spent a lot of my childhood in England and Denmark, then back to Russia, sort of an unusual path during those years. And I think one that was quite unique for just the kind of family, I guess, I came from. My parents were Russians, and there wasn't really much of an entrepreneurial spirit, as you can imagine, in the culture, so to speak, but somehow feel like I always had it. And for me, it was always about just finding some new thing, something that actually could be somewhat commercial in nature, whether it was, I'd say, tutoring English when I was a teenager, all the way through my university years, or helping a friend resell coats in an import-export exercise. And so those were kind of my early endeavors that really indicated that despite maybe the socialist transitioning to capitalist backdrop, I already had that spirit. So that was, I think, my beginning story.
So in moving around a lot and being exposed to what sounds like very different cultures, what were your takeaways? What did you draw from that? Was it difficult? Was it hard as a child to move around like that?
Not really. I think we're all very adaptable and flexible as children, and we kind of take life for what it is, and we don't overthink. We just follow the path and do the best we can. So I think, I don't know if I was a flexible child from the start or just became flexible as a result, but I think for me, it was just part of life. You know, you just move to a new place, you meet new people, then you move back, and perhaps you keep some of those relationships, perhaps you don't. You have to understand that this was also still the Soviet period, so it wasn't necessarily an open society. And I would argue, unfortunately, we're back to, you know, being a very closed society in that part of the world again. But you just didn't put too much weight. You just learned, I think, from and observed. And I think I did a lot of that. And I think that's a helpful skill that I've taken into adulthood.
Yeah, and I've noticed this with entrepreneurs and investors, and being an emerging GP is obviously a highly entrepreneurial endeavor, this ability to be multifaceted, to operate, especially your solo GP. So it's just a whole other dimension here of being able to straddle these different environments, different kinds of conversations and interfaces and all the different facets of the business that we'll talk about. What was your exposure to languages? Did you grow up predominantly speaking Russian, or did you learn, and what was the main language of your education growing up?
So I started school in England. So my preschool and early elementary school was in English, but my family language was Russian. So there was always that. Then my education was primarily in Russian up until I went to business school in Canada. But because I learned English, essentially, we moved to London when I was one. So I learned it from just a very, very early age and started my schooling there. I think it was just always kind of part of my brain. And so I always kept it up. When we lived in Denmark, I learned a little bit of Danish, but I didn't really speak it. Everyone spoke English in Denmark. And as you know, in Scandinavia, that's essentially a second language. So it was easy to get around in English. So I kept it up that way. In university, I learned French. And so now I basically speak 3 3/4 languages because I married a Spaniard. So Spanish became my 3/4 language. And so that's been sort of the evolution of my exposure to different cultures and languages. And I always loved languages. I guess I was pretty good with them. So that's, I guess, my experience to date.
Oh, that's amazing. And the reason I'm asking this is it also back to my own upbringing. My mother's 6 languages, one of them being Russian because she's half Russian, but like probably had similar upbringing. So I did spend some time in the UK growing up, and I learned English being a French citizen at a young age, and also spent some time in Norway. And as you know, also Norwegian and Danish are very close. But in the end, I think back to being exposed to all these different environments, I think at that young age, you're like a sponge. You really take it all in. And I think it's something that you keep, and I keep drawing back to the subject matter here that we're going to talk about, is this ability to absorb information and process it. And that's being thrown at you from a variety of different angles, and just be quick on your feet, be able to process all this. What were the types of topics that you gravitated towards as you started sort of forming an opinion of like taste of disciplines and the things that you did well, where you thought you had strengths both in high school, and then how did you make your choices with respect to university?
Yeah, well, I was a well-rounded student and I loved languages. That was something that was pretty natural to me. And that's probably because I just had that exposure to English and Russian at an early age. But in terms of my favorite subject, it was definitely math and science. And when I say science, I mostly mean physics. Those were my favorite subjects, hands down. I did okay in history and I guess social studies, if you will, but it was not ever a passion. I just kind of struggled with that, but plowed through and did well anyways, just because, you know, had a good work ethic, but definitely always gravitated toward the, you know, what's now known as STEM disciplines. I chose economics for my study in university, and that was really, I think, a more practical choice. I really wanted to study physics and astronomy specifically. I was really interested in space, but I just felt, how practical can that be? Maybe I should learn something that I can apply to a career. So, and it had enough of the elements that I really felt I could thrive with, such as math and I'd say international elements of business and languages, and all of that could come together and I could sort of bring a lot of my skills and make them useful.
Same, same. Again, I can totally relate to that. I mean, I was good at math, loved history and more the social sciences, but struggled to spend hours writing a long 5-page essay. I needed to get to the point, solve a problem. Econ was really a great mix because to me, it was sort of the equivalent of physics, what physics is to math. It's like applied in the real physical world, and econ was the same. So that's why I gravitated towards that. So is that how you got to essentially getting your start in financial services and on the banking side?
To be honest, not really. I mean, looking back, it seems logical, and maybe there was a little bit of that path being paved. I just didn't consciously maybe take those steps at every given point in time, but maybe subconsciously I was on this journey. But no, I actually ended up going to business school for a variety of reasons. You know, my family had moved to Montreal at that point, and I just felt that's something that I was going to do as my next educational experience. And I really loved school, to be honest. So I think I did know what I wanted to do for a while, even though I felt I was trying to pick something practical. But then business school emerged as the right option. And when I was in business school, I felt that I was well suited for consulting. I really was very interested in that field. And then I somehow ended up getting a summer job job doing credit analysis at the Bank of Montreal in Toronto. I went to school in Canada and really enjoyed that. And then when recruiting season came around for a full-time job, somehow finance was really on the table. It was something I was more interested in and more suited for with that interim experience. And then I ended up getting a job offer from Merrill Lynch in New York. It was one of the few U.S. firms that was recruiting on campus, and those were very desirable jobs by MBA students. And so I guess I somehow managed to edge out a number of other contenders and ended up in New York for, I guess, quite a long time now. But that was how I ended up in financial services.
So how were the first few months and years? I mean, I know this, I've gone through the training programs, and but it's always good for listeners, because those of us who've gone through it and our friends on Wall Street, like obviously there's the whole apprenticeship side to the business, right? I mean, literally when you start, I was having this conversation recently about the reason why you go on coffee task when you start on a trading desk or on a desk. There's reasons for that, right? It's, are you going to mess it up? Are you reliable? Can you check your ego at door despite coming from some big name school and being very, very intelligent, very smart? And it also allows you to build a rapport with people on the desk and build ties outside of just the work task. So, you know, those three pillars are actually essential for blending into this process that just basically sucks you in. And then once you're in, you just learn by osmosis, like you adapt. I'm wondering in your days, like how was it? What kind of environment was it? Also, let's face it, we'll talk about it in terms of the investment landscape, but a very male dominated environment as well. So I'm just curious as to like your first impressions as a financial services professional.
I'd say a little bit of a culture shock was my first impression, that's for sure. But, you know, I look back at my Wall Street days and there were many incredible learnings and incredible growth opportunities and realizations about myself as a person, as a professional, and as an independent thinker in terms of, I guess, what I gained out of that. And so I think what you just described in terms of the early days of how you prove yourself, that was definitely there. And I think what my coworkers wanted to know, and I haven't worked in the business for some time, but I imagine that's still to some degree the case, is people want to know if you're willing to do what it takes to succeed. If no task is too small, if you know your pride is not going to get in the way of certain things that just need to get done. I think that's an incredibly important quality on the trading floor, which is where I started. And interestingly enough, I think it translates very well into the startup world and the entrepreneurial world that I'm part of and have been part of for the last, I guess, 8-9 years. It's an incredible test. It doesn't feel good. You know, it definitely feels very lonely at times, especially if you don't see a lot of people who look like you around you. But I think you learn a lot. And this is where actually we do some psychoanalysis here and look back at childhood experiences. I think moving around a lot and having to adapt really served me well, because I think I am probably more comfortable than the average person feeling like I'm on my own and maybe I'm an outsider and I gotta figure out how to get it done. So it proved to be a valuable quality. And you're right, there were definitely not a lot of women on the trading floor. I think if we ever had like 5% of women who were in producing roles and not administrative roles, that was a number that the firm was proud of. And it's not just specific to that firm. I think it's the industry overall. So that's clearly a very sad number, you know, if you look kind of objectively. But I think every experience that you get in life, I just feel you have to figure out what you're supposed to take away from that. And then you do something with that information. And for me, now that I look back and see kind of my general journey, how it turned out and where it took me, I think it was all part of the progression. And I also worked with some incredibly smart people. I also worked with very difficult people. And those were all important experiences that I think I brought into subsequent chapters of my career.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything like the concentration of intellectual talent as there could be in Manhattan in financial services. I mean, it's just truly, if you think about the intellectual horsepower that's concentrated on that tiny island that is really global in nature, again, very multifaceted, the concentration coming from either the top schools and programs of the world or the best, brightest students of all schools in the world that come through this apprenticeship sort of sequence that you go through. And inevitably, I think the exposure to that will prepare you for most things in professional life. And I think that's why a lot of Wall Street professionals, whether they actually continue up the path of their career within their firms or eventually decide to do something else, are very well equipped in many of the other aspects that you described. describe. So talk to us a little bit about the progression, but I also want to get to, at which point did you start getting interested with venture capital and how did that transition happen? So I'm assuming there's a lot in between. And I'd love to hear also like how the in between really helped refine and your understanding of the industry that you're very focused on, which is fintech.
Yeah, definitely. So I had a couple of brushes with entrepreneurship throughout my financial services career, where I almost stepped out to do something very different. And for a variety of reasons, some personal, some professional, where I was maybe on the cusp of a promotion or better opportunity, or personally, it wasn't a great time to take a risk, I didn't. But I worked on a trading floor most of my career, and that was a very entrepreneurial environment. People don't think of it that way. They say, well, you worked at a large bank. How entrepreneurial could that be? But it was actually incredibly fun to do new things every day, where the market gave you new ingredients to work with. And in my role specifically, where I was working between issuer clients and salespeople who covered buy-side clients who wanted to buy certain instruments that I could create by working with my issuers, it was interesting that every day I could just come in and be creative. I could just say, all right, I'm going to print this trade today. And I put all the different pieces together. And it was definitely shorter horizon, but it was very exciting. And there were challenges, of course. So I don't want to misrepresent that it wasn't also a tough experience in many ways. But on the margin, if you're an entrepreneurial person, that's probably the best place for you to be out of all the different parts of other financial services or investment banking specifically. So that was, I think, my experience up until 2008, where the world blew up. And unfortunately, the consequence of that was the compliance pendulum swinging to the complete opposite side. And everything became so incredibly process-oriented for many good reasons, but it was also overkill, in my opinion. And I think for entrepreneurial people, it became just that much harder to stay motivated and excited. And so for me, that was the moment where between 2008 and 2012 is when I started thinking about what else I could do. So my first move was to leave Merrill Lynch and go to Jefferies with a bunch of people I worked with at Merrill. And we essentially tried to start up a new business there. And that felt like maybe that was going to be an iteration of the next entrepreneurial experience for me. That did not scale up according to our collective expectations. So I ended up going to JP Morgan into a different part of the industry, more on the buy side and private wealth side. And that was the time where I said, you know, I really need to think outside the financial services industry as much as I can think of what else I could do within the financial services industry that feeds that entrepreneurial drive. And that's when I got exposed to angel investing. I became a member of an angel group and started getting exposure to various events, various startups pitching. And the more I did that, the more I realized, and this was probably about a year into that, I realized that all I was thinking about was the deck that was going to arrive in my inbox because someone promised to send it to me like at 11 p.m. at night. That was more interesting to me than anything I was doing during the day. So that was something that was just undeniable. And I had to be honest with myself, that's where my brain and my heart were really driving me. And so it was obviously very tough to figure out what to do with that, because when you're investing as an angel, you're just laying out capital. You're not making any money. If I were to make that into a career, it was going to require a major risk and transition. And so that was certainly not easy, because leaving the safety of the corporate world, I guess I just hadn't experienced that, well, in whatever, I guess, period of time I'd been working. So it was something very, very big. And I had to get comfortable with that. So eventually, I ended up leaving the banking industry and taking a year off. I call it my year of extreme freedom, where I just said yes to most things that sounded interesting, as long as I could fit them into my schedule. Those were speaking opportunities to be on a panel. Those were advisory roles. Those were mentoring sessions. Those were, you know, getting involved with the accelerator programs and just building a personal brand and building my network of co-investors, founders, just partners throughout the startup ecosystem without asking too many questions of myself in terms of where's this going. So that was hard, but I stuck with it. And as a result of that journey, I actually ended up joining another fund. And that may be something I talk, if that's where these questions are going, I can talk about that a little bit too and kind of how I got to my current fund eventually. But those were the stepping stones in terms of how I left banking, started with this, you know, just deep passion that I discovered for the startup world, which was in complete contrast with the suffocation of any entrepreneurial thought or creativity that was happening in traditional banking at the time. And so for me, that was just the right turn at that moment.
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack. And I think for listeners, it's really important to understand because to us, I think, been around the block a little bit. It seems like yesterday, but it's been a while. So when I think of, oh, wait, now it's starting to move in a more distant past, but it's important to bring it back to understand that there was a pre-08 world and the world was forever changed after that, right? For so many reasons, but specifically as it applies to the economy, monetary policy, financial markets, there was just a confluence of things where we went from essentially in financial services, still a very old school, very entrepreneurial and risk-taking environment, especially on Wall Street. There was technology. There were tremendous advances in the quantitative fields of finance, for example. But it was still very much a heart of creativity when it came to financial engineering and how to maximize profits with leverage, with ingenuity. And suddenly we go into a world where the things that matter to be able to abide by the new rules, those macroprudential rules that came after the crisis, are automation, compliance, and risk management, right? Because if we think about it, automation or workflow reengineering is all about taking people out of the equation so that you actually minimize the risk of someone making a brass decision or someone making fat finger trade, any of that. Compliance, it's just a regulatory overlay that falls on financial institutions. And where, by the way, as an investor, I love this because I call it the inflation floor. It's just a gift that keeps on giving. It becomes more tedious year after year. So whether you're a direct RegTech business or you're just a business that sells to regulated entities, there's just things that need to be part of your product. And these things keep changing every year. And you can actually charge more money year after year. So that's why I call the inflation floor, because there's built-in inflation protection there. And then risk management, obviously, 08 was a case study in just a systemically over-levered financial system. And at the micro level, the idiosyncratic level of financial institutions, they're just, not to say that firms weren't risk managing, but I think everyone became acutely aware of, number one, that they needed to do a better job at understanding, for example, liquidity risk, but also, again, macroprudential rules like Basel III, especially I relate to like how to assess the credit worthiness of what's on the balance sheet and how to penalize capital against it. All these things require new systems, right?
Right.
And so I can understand how sitting there at the confluence of all this happening, if one has an entrepreneurial bent or identifies where the ingenuity is going to go, especially, again, in a world where capital is much cheaper through quantitative easing, it lies in the technology that's going to allow those financial services institutions to basically evolve and adapt in this new world.
Absolutely.
So that's my way of unpacking that journey. And it makes total sense that you kind of followed the entrepreneurial spirit where it was going to be. So still very much tied with your core industry, but coming at it from a different angle. But in the process also, and we've talked about this, you had a few wins, right? I mean, you identified businesses when we talk about, again, workflow reengineering, especially in the field of like trading. And I come from the corporate bond trading world. And you had a few wins there in the space and other parts of the fintech spectrum that allowed you to start building a track record, right?
Yeah, I did. So first, speaking of the angel experience, I think for anyone who is thinking about that or is doing that already, my personal takeaway from that experience was that it was incredible training ground for learning how to pick deals and how to avoid the duds that everyone is going to send you at first. And it takes a lot of discipline and a lot of networking and a lot of, I guess, analytical skills and just a lot of other, I guess, ingredients that you really have to pull into the deal selection, because as an angel, you definitely get adverse deal selection. That's just the first observation. So if you can do well as an angel, that I think is a more impressive accomplishment than if you do well as a brand name firm. And I think it's true in most industries, but that was kind of my maybe contrast from working in large financial firms where a lot of things just obviously come with being associated with that, then all of a sudden being this independent person trying to find good deals and rebuilding those networks and understanding just how important it was to see a lot of deals and make those selections with the right criteria and the right inputs and relationships. And so I think the journey itself as an angel was twofold for me. When I was working in banking still, I stayed away from fintech deals just because of compliance reasons. It was harder to get through something that could potentially be competitive to some part of the business of the firm. firm. So I did a number of investments in other industries where I actually learned patterns before I even got to apply them to the industry that I know best. That was actually very useful. And so by the time I was free, so to speak, and living my extreme year of freedom, I ended up looking at a lot more financial markets and financial services oriented companies. And that was really great to put those components together, the domain knowledge and some of the pattern recognition from other industries. So I was fortunate enough to build a portfolio that did very well. I invested in about a dozen companies, well, actually 10 companies, and had two exits. I had a company that was acquired by DocuSign and another company that was acquired by Block. And then I also was an investor in a company called Trumid. I'm still actually an investor in the company, but it's a unicorn multi times over and has been recognized as a fintech leader in the space through a number of top 50 lists and top, you name it, lists in the fintech universe. So very well-known platform, has been an incredible success. And I'm fortunate to be an early investor there. And the rest of my portfolio was comprised of companies that were not necessarily financial services oriented. Those three that I just mentioned happened to all be fintech, but I've had a couple of good outcomes and some neutral to negative outcomes as you'd expect in a portfolio. And I still have three companies that are, I think, in the process of getting to a really good outcome for me down the road. So that's something that I can say now. I built the portfolio over the 2014-15 period. So obviously it takes a long time for those companies to mature. But looking back now, I think I've did really well as an angel investor. But I think the companies that achieved the most impact and have already returned me meaningful capital and actually returned the portfolio capital outlay, the ones that married my domain expertise and the angel investing experience that I'd gathered up until then.
That's phenomenal. And what a great period, right? I mean, obviously there's market beta there, but clearly there's alpha that accrues to the individual security selection, right? And you can't have that, establish that sort of track record without that pattern recognition, that analysis that presumably you honed it over the years. So I'm looking forward to chatting a little bit more when we talk about the business now. So how do you parlay that into one day saying, all right, now's the time, I'm going to go out and I'm going to raise some LP capital and I'm going to start my own emerging manager?
Yeah, so I think a few ingredients played a role in that. One, I came from the institutional world. And so for me, it was always about having some kind of structure. So it was great to be doing things on my own, but in order to add more value to the portfolio, in order to have greater brand recognition, I felt that it was always going to be helpful to have some kind of capital vehicle, ideally a fund that would earn me a bigger place in that ecosystem and certainly would become more of an attraction for founders to work with me as a result. So as a stepping stone from coming from seemingly a different part of financial services to venture and trying to institutionalize that process, I joined another fund that was called Runway Venture Partners, focused on B2B SaaS investments here in New York. And I was one of the co-founders there. We deployed that fund. At this point, it's not making any new investments. I'm still involved with a handful of companies as a board member, and we're overseeing that portfolio to ultimate outcomes. But that was an important stepping stone for me to learn how to manage a fund, how to have gained the credibility ultimately with LPs that I started speaking to for this new fund, Altari Ventures. And I felt that was a way for me to essentially bring it all together. And Altari was born because I was thinking as a founder, actually, you know, I'm a solo GP. And I know there's occasionally this thread of conversation that I certainly have been part of where solo GPs are definitely founders, and maybe it's even a tougher road than, you know, some of the startup founder journeys, but it definitely is very, very similar. And so I actually came to this opportunity through that very process. Thinking as a founder, I saw an opportunity. I was looking at the market in 2021, and I saw these overheated, overpriced late stage rounds. I felt that if Runway were to go and raise a subsequent fund, we would have to look at our stage and beyond. And I was looking at Series A as kind of the next stage. And I felt that was the last place I wanted to. People were paying up to be in those deals and bidding away their return in the process. And that's just the opposite of the game that I felt I wanted to play. On the other hand, I looked at the earlier stage market, and I felt that that that's where you could see the opportunities and find companies and catch them before they've made those overspending mistakes. And that aligned with my general interests, and it aligned with the market dynamic that I was observing and where I thought you could build an attractive portfolio where you could have a more diversified pool of positions with limited capital at risk, but the return profile on the each individual position is asymmetrical, you know, in terms of upside. And I felt that would be the kind of portfolio that was right for the time and right for me. And so the only piece here that I haven't touched upon yet is the industry segment or the domain. And this is where my past background in financial services really came in very naturally, because I have a deep domain expertise in financial services. I felt that this would be an area where I could spot some of the opportunities early before they have those proof points that maybe the more traditional kind of later stage venture capitalists would be looking for. And this would enable me to actually find those gems before they become those gems and get in the right moment before the company is unhealthy in their spending pattern or before they've made certain mistakes that are very reversible. And just because I've seen several cycles in the public markets, I knew that whatever we were dealing with in the venture world was going to correct. I didn't know if it was going to be 2022 or 2023 or the specific moment, but I knew it was coming. So I wanted to build a strategy that was going to reflect not only the fact that I'm not going to be just competing on price to get into those deals, but also a strategy that would allow me to dollar cost average into the portfolio that I was building so that as I deploy capital over the course of 2 to 3 years, I would be coming in at more and more attractive prices in terms of valuations as the market corrects, as opposed to being disadvantaged by my portfolio that's underwater, that's trying to raise the next inflated round. So that's how I got to doing what I'm doing now. I really brought all my personal and professional experiences together. And the final question was really, do I have the right ingredients and experiences to execute on this strategy? And I felt strongly that I did. I felt like I understood the business. I understood it as a venture capitalist, an early stage investor. I understood it as a markets practitioner. I understood it as a financial services domain expert. And I also had the network that I've now been nurtured over the last 8-9 years to really allow me to source these deals appropriately and vet them appropriately, and also enhance some of the business development activities and subsequent financing activities that these companies might need help with. And so that's why Altari Ventures was born.
That's a great story. And it's interesting because you're coming at it with, I would say, like a fairly unique, which is great, right? Differentiation is key, especially when, I don't know what the exact count of the number of VC funds right now in the US, but it's just a staggering number, definitely in the thousands. The notion that you're already thinking ahead around the graduation path, right? From one round to another, and thinking about what the gating factors is and what is the discipline that you need to have along that path. And there's contrasting views. And obviously, when markets get really frothy, the discipline flies out the windows. People get FOMO. They get a little bit more focused on the train that everyone's on, and that discipline goes away. So you sort of have to stay very disciplined and very strong-minded. But the approach that you're taking is very much one that probably stems from your professional upbringing, especially in fixed income, right? And when all you think about is downside, you think about every basis point matters, because that's a basis point that's going to be taken out of your yield at the end of the day. And so you become much more aware of the granular detail that it really takes to accrue and compound over time. How do you contrast that with the West Coast mentality where you got to think big, you have to be ambitious? And I'll be honest, like as someone who straddled both tech world, but always like very New York centric and worked on Wall Street as well, sometimes it's hard to think like guys out in Silicon Valley, like just have this $1 trillion, like Sam Altman going out and raising, you know, trillions of dollars for something. Like we seem to be a lot more focused on the down to earth aspect of like, okay, how do I take this business to the next level and make sure that I maximize my risk adjusted return?
Yeah, I think there's a very clear difference between the East Coast and West Coast approach. And I think it was probably more different during the boom years. And I think now we're maybe coming a little bit closer together because the adjustments happened on the West Coast. But still, I think capital is pretty unlimited for some of the buzzy kind of sectors and opportunities that are perceived to be just the outlier. So it took me a while to get my arms around how I think about this, because I think you're right to think about about the opportunity from both sides. You can't just think about the downside. You can't just think about the upside. Neither one is going to get you. You're always going to say no, because especially with an early opportunity, there's going to be way too many things that can go wrong, because you will never get to certainty no matter how much due diligence you do. You just have to have that leap of faith. And whether it's the people you're betting on, or you believe the market is going there, or there are other elements of what you need to get comfortable with. On the West Coast, it's very much about, how do I not miss that next big thing? And so it's okay to dream big, but I just feel like the happy medium, like each opportunity as a result is a balance of those factors and what you can get behind. At least that's how it is for me. I think what makes me good for my role, and this is my own account, sort of an assessment of myself that I do regularly, is that there are sort of the more objective things about the business opportunity, and then there's the more subjective part about the people executing it. But I would say that you have to have both hard and soft skills. And for me, analytical, I think I'm good at breaking down business issues and problems into components, and then down to factors that can really make or break the company ultimately. So I'm not always right, but I feel like I have, that's my natural process, and I think I'm pretty good at it. And then the balance of it, when I break it down into those ingredients, okay, can I see this balance working out, and can this company build in a responsible way? And what happens if things go wrong, and what happens if things go right? And that's really ultimately the kind of the place where I spend a lot of time, because you can get all the facts, you can talk to a lot of people, you can do all your diligence, and you're kind of left sitting with all of that information. And frankly, it's going to be, I think, individual for all the different investors that are looking at it. And there is sort of the right combination that I think works for me. And it's probably going to be a little bit different for you. And it's going to be very different for maybe a very representative West Coast investor. But I'm also, you know, you made this point, and I think it was a very accurate summary of parts of what I was saying about being on the trading floor. There's this risk-taking mentality. You know, you can't really be an early stage investor and be afraid of risk. I think you just have to think of acceptable risk and risk on a portfolio basis. I alluded to this earlier with the portfolio construction. If you think about a risk profile of a portfolio of early stage investments, you have these relatively inexpensive options that you've bought on all of these potential companies that are going to do well, but you have the portfolio outcome that you have to look at. So you can't look at this company individually likely to fail. It's far more likely to fail than maybe something that's got a lot more capital or is a lot further along with revenue and other proof points. But you need to kind of think of it in components that will drive the success or failure of one company, get comfortable with that balance, and then see where that fits in with your portfolio and see if that's still a risk worth taking or maybe not worth taking for those portfolio reasons as well. So I think the short answer to all of this, it's a complex process. And I wish I had the one right answer, but I think it's always situation dependent. And I think you have to be really good at working with all of these different components and uncertainties and factors that are going to play into each other. And in the end, believe that the team you're backing has the right approach to build a business that can scale up if the opportunity is really running away and really succeeding. And then it also has the acumen to manage it in a financially responsible way if things are taking longer or things are not going quite that way.
Makes total sense. And I think we're getting to patterns, right? I mean, let's talk a little bit about that pattern recognition that people talk about in the venture space in terms of making sure that you avoid the duds, to your point, and you kind of hone in your craft over time. What are some of those patterns as it relates to teams, for example? I have a lot of opinions on that. I'd love to hear yours as you look for opportunities. Like if we discuss a little bit your due diligence, so you've talked about your overall top-down risk DNA and how you balance the upside and downside views in a very thorough way, right? Most people in the space don't really talk about portfolio of options, like you and I could relate on that. So it's very thorough and also very, very top-down from a construction standpoint, down to the individual security selection and the underwriting process. What do you look for? Like, what are the key highlights? Not that we could spend an entire 5 hours discussing this, obviously, is what are the things that I think for people thinking about doing angel investing or looking at you as a manager of their funds, what are the things that really drive your due diligence process?
Yeah, so I'll touch upon the deal itself, and then I'll talk a little bit about the team, because I think, just going back to the points about hard and soft skills, I think those are equally important, especially in early stage investing. So when it comes to deal selection, there are a number of factors. I'm very vocal about some of the thesis buckets that I have that I find personally interesting. So I tend to look for those elements. If I were to just sum it up in one tagline, I would say it's where the fan matters as much as the tech to the ultimate success of the business. So those are kind of the, like, I'm not going to get interested in a consumer focused business in any industry or, you know, hardware, or it's really software where the fan matters as much as the tech to the product and the user experience and the selling process. And that's just the high level, I think, screen that I do. And I invest in enterprise fintech, which I love the term enterprise fintech better than B2B fintech, because under the enterprise bucket, I look at things that are also horizontal solutions where financial services may be a customer, but it could also be other industries that the solution could be applicable to. That typically has to do with data-driven enterprise intelligence, just data in general. And a lot of people would liken this to the AI bucket, which to me, it's important that AI is a tool, but it's not the sort of everything about the company. So I tend to look at it always through the business side of things. And then there are some other more specific deep financial services like capital markets, asset management tech, CFO tech stack, payments, embedded finance. Those are sort of the themes. So it has to fit into that. I stay very disciplined around not falling victim to FOMO, like, oh, everyone's doing this really cool thing and I got to have a piece of that in my portfolio. I'm willing to trade off the lack of shine, if you will, for something that I think long-term uncovers an incredible opportunity. In a way, I don't want to say I'm contrarian, but it can be contrarian at times. And I think that kind of strategy is a harder road, but it's also that lack of acceptance at first, I think, can give rise to scarcity value to my strategy down the road as I prove it out. So discipline is really important, because otherwise I won't have that argument to make. The other piece when I look at a deal or source a deal or evaluate a deal is my network and my own domain expertise. And by network, I mean both financial services as well as my co-investor network. Where are some of the industry relationships that I can not only use to vet this deal and maybe in the process even get my portfolio company's customers as they demo the product and put their value proposition in front of prospective customers in my network as part of diligence, but also kind of longer term, where do I see myself potentially being helpful? So those are important. It's not in every case that I have the exact connectivity. I may see something else in the deal that it's not always, I guess, so cut and dry, but those are important to consider. And typically I have some part of that where my network can be valuable. So that's, I think, on the deal side. And, you know, I look for all the typical things that other investors look for, you know, market size, scalability, go to market, is this credible? Can I get behind this? Well, the standard things that any investor would think through, is this potentially a healthy business? Can you build something that can get to either stand on its own 2 feet within a reasonable period of time or really get to off the charts growth that becomes a true outlier? So I think through that as well. But I think I want to talk about the team now, because the team is really what makes all of that happen. And this was probably the biggest adjustment for me coming from the world of fixed income, where everything's about numbers. You know, if there is a price, it's probably a function of discounted cash flows, you know, that a certain instrument has. And if the price in the market deviates from that, then that's for either a good or stupid reason that we should somehow be taking advantage of as traders or portfolio managers. So thinking kind of people as being an important ingredient and possibly as important as everything else is really different. And so it took some time to get to this realization, but I think it's really critical to understand that a team that is poorly equipped or poorly positioned or just has the wrong dynamics or has the wrong styles, not transparent and honest, you know, can really drive the business into the ground very quickly, even if it's a fantastic idea. And so I do spend a lot of time looking at that. Wall Street, interestingly enough, has been really helpful for me in that regard, because having worked on the trading floor, I saw people perform, I guess, act badly or incredibly under stress. There's a lot of stress, lots of money moving around. There's typically a huge time constraint where you have to make a decision, and some really good qualities and some really, really bad qualities come out. And so I kind of had this, I feel like it was like a fast forward kind of watching a movie at an accelerated pace where you could see how this whole thing plays out very quickly. And so then I think subconsciously, I, being an observant person, started putting putting all of that together with maybe how the person operates outside of that stressful environment, and what are some of the signals or signs that I'm starting to pick up on, and maybe draw patterns, recognize patterns, you know, for the types of people that I think can do certain things and the types of people I want to work with, and people that I don't think can do that or that I do not want to be in business with. So to make a long story short, I think, what does that really mean in practice for me? So I do look for some domain expertise. That's definitely kind of one area. I want the person to be competent in what they're talking about. And I imagine them not just talking to me, but talking to customers, talking to other investors, and how they present themselves. Do they know what they are talking about, and are they credible? That's definitely an element that is important right off the bat and is part of trust building. I look for people who are resilient, resourceful, driven, if not passionate. And I also look for people who are very transparent and honest in their business dealing. One of the worst things that you can have is a founder going silent, and then, you know, when they resurface, you know, it's game over or something really major has gone wrong. So definitely people who are not that type, the people that I prefer to be in business with. You can't always recognize this with certainty, but I do my absolute best to build a relationship with them over a period of time so I could see how they interact. And, you know, as I said a little bit earlier, I look for people I want to be in business with for 10 plus years. So trust is a significant component in that. And that comes from, obviously, honesty and communication expertise, but also just being a decent human being where, you know, I think you can build a good rapport and collaborate. And I think that's really, really important to me.
I'm so glad you expanded on this also as part of like how you approach the underwriting side of things, because clearly like you've got a very well-defined origination process. But since it's such a significant component of the equation, it's 65% of startups fail due to founder conflict, for example. It's like identifying teams that have highly non-overlapping skills. You talk about portfolio, teams like a portfolio, right? You need to make sure that when someone's down, the other one can counterbalance, but they can also create inherent good positive correlation, at least to the upside. And the way they interact with you is, to your point, is going to be a good proxy for how they react. And that pattern that you just highlighted of going dark and then reappearing, I've seen it before, not a good sign. You know, typically it's not a sign of transparency. It seems like there's a tendency to overamplify the good news and not be able to have the serious conversation when things aren't going according to the plan. And inevitably, as you and I know, right, a startup life is filled with way more bad news than it is with good news, at least in terms of observation points. And hopefully the good news are asymmetric to the upside, but there's just a lot of grind in between. So the ability of the founders to, you know, just simple things like send investor updates. And sometimes an investor updates is not fun to write because there might be a month or a quarter where things aren't going well and you're not growing 300%, you know, over a quarter. And maybe you've lost a few people, and then maybe like something's buggy and it's not working. Some customers unhappy. You need to be able to talk through this with your investors. And thankfully you're not a publicly traded company. Like there won't be an immediate impact on price. So that level of transparency is very important. So I'm really happy we touched on this because, again, for people who are looking to either get into angel investing or other investors, understanding those nuances. And of course, there's a bias that builds over time, but I think it's hard to develop this pattern recognition without having seen, at least having a sample and having seen, to your point, people behave in incredibly stressful situations is actually a good proxy for entrepreneurship.
Yep.
It's actually incredibly similar. And for those of us who've straddled both worlds, like we can actually recognize what those similarities are. So let's talk a little bit about what I think you're passionate about. 2024, you've put out some really interesting pieces. I know there's some key topics that you're very keen on as it relates to your investments. So I want to talk about data, because I know you care about that a lot, and how to think about data in a world where you have, you know, legacy financial institutions that produce a tremendous amount of data, both on payment side of things, the banking side of things, lending, trading. I want to talk about risk. You come from a risk background, and that's an area that you think is a big draw of adoption for technology, and also the overall potential of the sector in terms of the wallet size. So love to hear your thoughts on those three topics.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think about this a lot. As you mentioned, I've put out some thoughts on that. So anyone who's listening who wants to go and read more can obviously find that out for themselves. But I do want to make a few key points. So data is definitely the cornerstone of a lot of things that I look at and what I still find very exciting. And you'd say, we've been talking about data, big data, small data, you know, enriched data, you name it. There've been all kinds of data that has been the hot topic. But I think what's happening in financial services in general, in my observation, is that we still have a lot of inefficiencies that exist in parallel with each other, no matter how much innovation has been implemented by firms with maybe best-in-class technology at different points in time. But we still have a problem of just data collection and ingestion. It's either still very inefficient and data is missed, or sometimes companies don't even know that they're missing certain data. Sometimes this data is buried in silos. Sometimes it's buried in workflow tools, and it's not really being pulled together and evaluated at the enterprise level, where maybe that's actually going to connect to my risk topic in a second. But I think that is all super important, is the real foundation for being able to assess your enterprise-wide risk. So if you are dealing with imperfect data, your AI tools are useless, your other ways of assessing risk are useless, just because you're going to be missing components of, I guess, where risk might be actually sitting, and you're not even aware of that happening. So that inefficiency is problem number one. Automation of everything to do with data, whether it's data collection itself, whether it's combining that data with other kinds of data to make it more useful, then ultimately translating that into actionable insights, because that's what data is really there for. You know, you don't want just data to know that you have it. You really need to know, what can you do as an enterprise as a result of having all this information and doing the analysis on top of that to figure out how to optimize your operations, be it cost cutting, be it new product opportunities, and everything in between. So I think that's a super important starting point. And data itself, you know, just because you have better data than someone else is not enough. You have to do something with it. And I think where we are moving over time, as I said, there's a lot of inefficiencies. So I can't say the whole industry is moving kind of together, but we are moving eventually toward real-time data. So before we can get there, we have examples of that where real-time data is already available in certain parts of the industry, and that's being utilized for making investment and risk management decisions, but it's not universally true. And some data is only available in a backward fashion where you could go back and see what happened, but you don't know what's happening real-time. So I'm very excited about this transformation of data getting significantly better and becoming increasingly more real-time. I just put out an article in American Banker where I talked about spending data, for example, as part of credit risk management and what that means for loan books within banks. I mentioned in the article that I meet with founders regularly who say, well, banks want to lend more, but they can't because they don't have enough data. And I always tell them, I challenge that. They have a lot of data. The point is, having more data is unlikely to move the decision from a no. You have to have the right data to do that. And it's not about the amount of it as much as the quality or the meaning of that data. And so it's kind of an interesting conversation, but I spend a lot of time talking to founders in that space. This is actually universal for all enterprises. So financial services is one bucket, and it's a big problem there across a bunch of different sub verticals. But I think it's even broader than that. And this is why I have that data-driven enterprise intelligence bucket under my thesis. Risk management is one of my favorite topics. In fact, it's possibly my 2024 topic. You know, I haven't decided yet. We're in February now, but I'm slowly starting to realize that that's a theme that is really representative in my portfolio. I have a lot of companies that are addressing, I'd say, different kinds of problems on the surface. Some might be addressing knowledge management. Some might be addressing purely financial risk, like algorithmic corporate bond trading or liquidity risk in the securities lending space, or some other just sort of reputational risk buckets and issues that companies may be dealing with. But ultimately, what brought them into my view and made them exciting to me is that I saw the common theme that the reason customers were engaging with them is that they are addressing a risk that the company is sitting on and is managing somehow inefficiently. Sometimes it's a risk that they don't even fully have their arms around, but they know it's a risk and it's not really an option to not manage it. So they're doing their best, but they know they're kind of exposed. And the reason that's important is because technology is very difficult to sell into organizations that already have maybe some other tools, maybe their point solution, and maybe you have a better solution that's aggregating all of that, but you still have to deal with them having to potentially rip out everything else they've put in place. And that's really hard to do. So the only way that you get organizations, especially large enterprises, to think about doing that is when they realize that there's a consequence to not using your technology. And then it becomes a very different conversation. They just think, oh, it's just a better way of doing things, chances are they're going to be moving really slowly. It's going to be a 3-year sales cycle, you know, maybe longer, maybe never. But if you start the conversation with highlighting this from a risk management perspective, if you really hone in on the consequence of not having that done appropriately, the consequences could be different, right? Like it could be an outright financial loss. Like if you miscalculated or misassessed a particular risk where you didn't know it existed, and then all of a sudden it cost you dearly. Reputationally, it could be customer loss. It could be future customer loss. It could be a lot of things that are going to take time to repair if you found to not do what's expected of you. And then there's also potentially a regulatory consequence for financial services firms specifically, which we know the regulatory is a pendulum, as I talked about 2008. When it swings, and then it stays. And that burden is actually very, very significant on the cost structure of these organizations. So I think if you find, as a founder, the right angle for this conversation and you hone in on a risk that the enterprise is not dealing with or not doing, I guess, the best they could, and you position your conversation that way and you demonstrate that you could help them avoid those consequences, that becomes a lot more interesting. And so I spent a lot of time trying to kind of evaluate businesses as an additional layer of my framework for deal selection. Is there a real risk for not using this technology or this type of technology or this type of solution for the target customer that they're selling to versus this just being a better, easier, prettier way for them to maybe present information or just communicate internally or externally? And the last theme that I think is interesting, in a way it sort of connects to some of these other things that I talked about. You know, I referred to this as fat margins are still out there in one of my pieces. And I do think that is the case. If you think of financial services as an industry, I think the latest estimate I saw that it's a $12.5 trillion annual revenue pool and $2.3 trillion of profit pool and 18% profit margin. Those were some numbers that I'd gathered from my research earlier this year. And to me, that's just a huge amount of opportunity for some efficiency to come in and create better products that are easier to administer, take out some costs, reduce that margin that is now essentially there sometimes because external parties don't even know it's there. And sometimes it exists because the process is so inefficient that the organizations are covering the things they don't know with just a bigger addition to the fee, just in case. If you can really leverage the data, if you can use that risk management framework, and then if you can apply that to those margins, you actually are not going to just rob financial services firms of the ability to be profitable, but you are going to optimize the whole system. And some of that redistribution will happen of those fees and those profits to some of these companies that are actually bringing that efficiency. And so to me, that's very interesting. And I am looking for companies and thinking about these matters on an ongoing basis. So definitely a top of mind for me.
That's great. And it's very helpful for us to get a full picture of how, again, we've gotten the full unwrapping of your top-down sort of how I think about constructing a portfolio, how I think about risk and upside and downside, then deep down into your pattern recognition, your selection processes, how do you underwrite the risk? We know about the origination part, got a decade of being in the space, plus your history in financial services that gives you not only a good vantage point to identify opportunities, but also have the people to talk to vet both on the customer side as well as on the builder side or fellow venture investors. So it's a pretty complete picture there that makes for a very interesting value proposition. So I'm really glad we got to spend time today to talk through this. What a fascinating background and path and journey. Again, bias, I sort of relate because there's a lot of similarities in the worlds we've interacted with, but you've certainly over the last decade built a very impressive track in building Alteri now. Looking forward to seeing it developed and as you work through several iterations of the fund. So I'm excited to keep in touch and continuing to chat about it.
Thanks so much, Maxime. I really enjoyed being here and appreciate our growing relationship and hope to be in touch soon.
This podcast is produced by Rado Venture Management LLC, RVM. RVM is not an investment advisor. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent, not investment advice.